Good day, and welcome to the Brewers Association State of the Craft Brewing Industry teleconference. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. Later, you'll have the opportunity to ask questions during our question-and-answer session. On the phones, you may register to ask a question anytime by pressing star and one on your touch-tone phone, and you may withdraw yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. It's now my pleasure to turn your conference over to Julia Herz. Please go ahead.
Thank you, everyone, and to the participants on the phone, as well as about 50, 45 of you in the room. Welcome, as Keith on the phone said, to the Craft Brewers Conference and Brew Expo America Press Conference. This is the 33rd CBC, and we're definitely of the time, so you will notice a component of this presser has media also who have called in and are not present on site. We're going to go over the agenda, and I'll introduce my colleagues in a moment, but as you might have just heard, I'm Julia Herz, the Craft Beer Program Director at the Brewers Association. I look forward in this press conference for us to be overviewing multiple amounts of topics. Then we'll go into a Q&A session. A few notes of operation just for you guys. When you do ask a question, whether you're in the room and obviously on the phone, we need you to be speaking into the phone or into the microphone in the room here. We just presented the state of the industry, and it is now live on the craftbrewersconference.com website under the press section. So if anyone wants access to that deck, that is now live and accessible for you. When we do get to Q&A, we will alternate back and forth between the room and the phone. And with that, we're going to kick it off to Paul Gatza to my right and your left. He is the director of the Brewers Association. Paul will co-present with Bart Watson a little bit, and Bart is our chief economist, a little bit about what they just presented in the state of the industry. Then Bob Pease, our CEO and president, will talk about a multitude of topics, and then I will pick it up from there on some of the lifestyle things that are going on for the craft segment. Then we will go to Q&A. So, Paul?
Thank you, Julia. I've got four things on my list here. The first is our keynote presentation. Then I want to talk about some of the deals that I was referring to in the general session. And then I want to talk about some of the industry concerns and then mention what's going on the regulatory front. And certainly at the end of it all, I'll be happy to answer any questions there. You know, we're really happy to have Billy Bean as our keynote speaker. He made a good connection of being creative in against competitors with greater resources, which is a challenge similar to the challenge that craft brewers face. Right afterwards, one member of the media asked me, you know, what was the deal with not, you know, being able to cover his comments. Just want to address that head on. When we've the last 3 years, we've had out of industry speakers in our keynote slot, Michael Pollan and Simon Sinek last year, and now Billy Bean. And each time we do that, we have a contractual arrangement, and that has different, you know, uses of materials and requirements. And one of those requirements was that media not be able to, you know, basically talk about what he talked about. And so I made the decision that, yes, we did want Billy Bean here, even if it did mean that, you know, we had to have that restriction. I know that makes your jobs a whole lot tougher, and I apologize that we had to take that step, but that's what we did so that we could present Billy to our members. With deals, this is a topic that is definitely on the minds of craft brewers because it's tough to sort through the issue emotionally when, you know, you see friends or brands that you have an attachment to all of a sudden go to what people think, what you may think of as, you know, the rival team, companies that are competing against you in a manner that isn't filled with camaraderie, but that does create more challenges. So it's kind of hard for craft brewers to really, you know what to think in those situations. But, you know, it's an issue out there, and there have been deals, and there's going to be more deals coming. The deals go through a variety of formats. Large brewers buying small brewers, small bulk brewers buying other small brewers, private equity investments in small brewers, and small brewers doing, you know, forming ESOPs. And I'm sure there are other arrangements that I didn't bring up in there, but, you know, each deal is its own animal, so to speak. Let's see. So deals tend to be about access to capital and building scale or paying off the original investor group. While the large brewer purchases of small brewers get most of the press, you know, there are these other arrangements there. You know, large buying small, I think it's, 10 or 11 total over the last 30 years. So it's really not a huge number, but they did accelerate in 2014 and 2015. And, you know, we had one in 2016 already. So it is something that is definitely on our mind. And I did mention that beer drinker backlash can be large or small. When the social media response is bitter and critical, there's a thought that they're exchanging some of those core customers for the potential of the brands once they get spread by the larger brewer nationally or perhaps even internationally. And once a brand is dealt, there, it does make the brand vulnerable to being dealt again. With some of the concerns that I mentioned for craft brewers, I challenge craft brewers to stay connected to each other and be involved with their state brewers guilds to help craft maintain the unique camaraderie that we've had between customers over the decades. And that sort of makes us special. We are different than other industries, and you know, it would be a shame if we lost that. But so I think paying attention to our own community and making sure that we keep those bonds strong is something that's very important for the future of craft brewers. While quality gaps are fewer among brewers, some still don't know they have the quality issues and are putting putting some substandard beers out there. And so we're hoping that with the tools and resources, for example, we published a book on quality management that we sent out to all of our members last year, that you know, the ones that don't really know what they're doing will start to do better at what they do. The beer drinker will weed them out if they don't get better. And another newer impact that I mentioned from the stage is that distributors are no longer taking every brand that becomes available to them in their territories, that they are starting to turn down some, even when they are of high quality. And I think that's a sign of the limited shelf space as well as distributors honoring their commitments to the brewers that are already in their distribution houses. That may make it a little trickier for startups to, on the packaging side, who, you know, want to enter markets going forward. But you're going to have to make really good beer then, I guess, in some markets. And on the regulatory side, California Proposition 65 signage requirements, those rules go into effect May 11th. Also, the FDA put out final guidance on menu labeling on Friday. As soon as it publishes in the Federal Register, that sets the one-year clock ticking where chain restaurants will need to comply with those regulations. And also mentioned about chain retailer supplier requirements. A couple of the giant retail chains out there are going to start requiring brewers to provide information on, you know, package, price, brand, 4 ounce can, 12, 16 ounce cans, and what are all the attributes in there, IBUs. And they're also looking, at least one of them is looking to make brewers pay for that service. So that is something that could be concerning coming forward. And I think I'll wrap it there.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Bar Watson. I'm the Chief Economist of the Brewers Association. Thanks for being here. I'll say up front that the vast majority of numbers that come out of my mouth, sometimes far too rapidly, are on our website. So if you didn't catch something I said, it's likely in the statistics section of our website, or if you go to our press releases page, our latest national press release is up there. 2015 was another good year for America's small and independent craft brewers. We counted 4,269 total breweries, of which 99%, 4,225, would fall under our craft brewer definition and data set. Their production grew by 13%, up to approximately 24.5 million barrels. And their retail dollar sales, so the final spending that consumers made on their products, went up 16% to, and I'm blanking on the number now for a second, $22.3 billion, I believe, which was, again, a record high. We're also seeing a strong number of breweries in planning. I referenced in my presentation that TTB number. That's a good indicator that there are a lot more breweries in planning. And the gap between the brewery number that we give and that number is a likely indicator of number of breweries that are actually going to open. They've gone down the path of actually getting a federal license. A couple of things that I didn't touch on that maybe add a little bit of depth and character to what was in the state of the industry. One, on the economic impact side, I referenced the jobs. Actually, it's nearer to 122,000 and growing every year. But there's also the economic impact piece. That was $55.7 billion when we last measured it. It's actually a 2014 number, however. We do that study every 2 years. And so it's likely that that economic impact has grown. In addition, that doesn't cover a lot of other things the craft brewing industry does. For instance, this conference. Visit Philly has estimated that this conference is bringing $23.8 million in economic impact to the city of Philadelphia, and there are beer festivals and conferences all over the country that are doing similar things. I'll also just, I won't go through them all, but also point out that there are state statistics on our website, both for economic impact and for a number of breweries, the production of those breweries, and breweries per capita. So if you are writing a story and you want to make it specific to your state, I would recommend going to the statistics section of our website and checking out the state-by-state stats.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Bob Pease, President and CEO of the Brewers Association. I've been asked to speak to you briefly this morning about a handful of topics, the global merger between Anheuser-Busch InBev and SABMiller, the acquisitions of independent breweries undergoing on in the beer landscape over the last few years, our export development program, and then our brief update on other government affairs-related initiatives the BA is involved in. So where I would start, I guess, I'll start with talking a little bit about the merger and what's going on there. You know, there's been a beer renaissance in this country that's been driven by the small and independent craft breweries. The cultural and the community impact that these 4,400 small and independent breweries are having around the country goes far, far beyond just the production of beer, the employment, importance of the employment that they represent, the way these companies run their businesses. It's just a whole cultural phenomenon that you can't really underestimate. In our mind, small and independent breweries have really saved beer in this country. Beer didn't used to look like this. It all kind of all looked the same, and it looks a whole lot different now, and we want to preserve that. We want to preserve that variety that the consumer is demanding. The merger, if it goes on through unchecked without adequate protections, we feel would lead to a very tilted playing field for small and independent breweries. It would result in reduced access to market for our members, and I think most importantly, reduced access to choice for the beer drinker. And if my comments yesterday talked about all this is being driven by the beer drinker. If the market is left pretty much alone, we feel that our members will do just fine. Our members aren't afraid to compete. And right now, that interesting dynamic that's in the beer industry is what we call consumer pull. It's the beer drinker demanding all these varieties, this innovation, these flavors, this experimentation. And as long as that is left unfettered, we're going to be just fine. But what we see happening is the largest global brewer trying to change the dynamic in the beer world to what we call supplier push, where they, one supplier, provides to their distributors, one portfolio of beers, and, we think that's not good, to put it mildly. The merger is going to result in, the global corporation, the largest global corporation in beer having greater resources, greater scale. They'll be able to disrupt things on the raw materials market. And most importantly, as I think most people know, Anheuser-Busch InBev is the largest beer producer in the world by far, and they are the largest beer distributor in this country. And by and large, small independent breweries need to use a distributor, generally speaking, to get their products to market. AB InBev has, in the last 8 months, purchased formerly five independent distributors. And when that happens, that closes off one of the routes to market for small and independent breweries. And so that's kind of our message when we're in there talking to the Department of Justice, the regulators who are looking at this deal, and expressing our concerns. And it's tough to say where they're going to fall. If I was handicapping, I'd say they're probably going to let the deal go through, but we're hoping with some, in DOJ parlance, some remedies that will protect the issues we've been bringing to their attention. So I'll move on to that, talk a little bit about acquisitions. It seems like there's been a ton of acquisitions, but what I think AB InBev has purchased eight independent breweries over the last few years. I think that also includes the Goose Island purchase in 2011. And to me, it's really those purchases that are the greatest concern to the Brewers Association and our members. And again, that's tied to ABI's impact at the distribution tier. One large brewing company buying one brewery in San Diego, I knew the Ballast Point guys when they were a homebrew supply store. Good work if you can get $1 billion, right? But it's that impact at the distribution tier and the control that AB InBev has at distribution that is the greatest concern for us. It's an association, free market economy. We respect the right of any brewer to do what they want with their business. They built it up from the ground up, entrepreneurial, sweat equity, so we're not going to second guess them. But the acquisition of SAB Miller, the purchasing of independent breweries, and the increased activity of ABI at the distributor level is all interrelated. None of these are happening in a vacuum. And so that's kind of our message to the federal government. I'll move on from those two issues, the merger and acquisitions, talk a little bit about some other government affairs stuff. First up, just the Craft Beverage Modernization Tax Reform Act. You might have heard some of the comments from the stage this morning. Great industry, beverage alcohol industry coalition pushing that. And besides the Beer Institute and the Brewers Association, the Wine Institute and Discus and the craft distillers are all very active, and also Wine America as well, advocating for this legislation. So it's a pretty powerful coalition in Washington, and it's great not to be kind of at odds with the other trade associations in moving this forward. And we've come close. It's great to hear the head of the Beer Institute up there saying he thinks it's going to pass this year. I've been doing it a little longer than him, so I'm a little more pessimistic. The benefits that the Brewers Association gets for advocating for tax legislation are innumerable. That's gotten us in to tell our story to federal and to congressional representatives at the federal level and also at the state level. And we've got a great story and a great message to tell. And wrapping up, I want to talk a little bit speak about our export development program. I'm still kind of in charge of that. I guess I'm in charge of it because nobody else wanted to do it when we started it in 2004. But I'm very proud of that program. We've grown it to, I think, one of our more effective programs at the Brewers Association. We've done a ton of great work, and I'd like to take just a quick opportunity to, founder, the visionary of the export program for the Brewers Association was Jack Joyce from Rogue Ales back in the early 2000s. He really saw that international component and saw the future. I'd like to give a quick shout out to Jack. As things tighten up at home, more and more breweries are looking to export. And as you saw on the panel, exports are up to 446,000 barrels, represents a 16% increase, still very small base. It's probably we estimate about 100 breweries that are actively exporting, and we have about 110 breweries that are part of our export development program. We're active in a bunch of different markets. I was just in Paris doing a dinner with 20 leading French lifestyle journalists with BA executive chef Adam Dooley. My colleague Mark Schneider was just at a big beverage alcohol show in South Korea with about five of our members that were over there. So there's a lot of interest in the export markets. And, that's what this trade association is supposed to do. It's supposed to help open new markets for their members. And we get money from the federal government to help fund our efforts on the export program. And we use it in a variety of ways. We enter international beer competitions on their behalf. We do beer and media food dinners like the one we did in Paris all over the world. We do conferences and trade shows. We've got did the one in South Korea. We'll be doing one in Mexico later this year. We'll have a big booth at the Brow in Nuremberg. And then we also have two representatives in different parts of the world helping advocate for us. We've got a European craft ambassador. Her name's Sylvia Kopp. Many of you know. She's based out of Berlin. And then we have a representative in Shanghai, China as well. So I will wrap there. Good? Yep. Okay.
Thank you, Bob. And excuse me, Julia Herz back to the microphone now for those on the phone. And great segue into marketplace endeavors. So I'll just quickly review what I was able to share on the main stage yesterday during the first general session. And there's kind of themes to that. One piece of the marketplace endeavors that we have going on behalf of, you know, promoting and protecting American craft brewers, their beers, and the community of brewing enthusiasts is tied to where we came from, where the community of brewers came from. And so just yesterday, we announced the Brewers Association as the lead sponsor for the new Smithsonian's National Museum of American History Brewing History Initiative. This is a very exciting initiative for us to be a part of and see fueled by the number one history museum in the world. And it's part of their Smithsonian Food History Project. This is a three-year program that we are now signed on to be a part of and get the community engaged to participate. The Smithsonian will tell you very eloquently that they've documented brewing history from 1870 to 1960, but now they're interested in beefing up 1960 to today. And so that's what we're going to start to see unfold in the next 3 years. Two representatives from the Smithsonian are here today. Susan Evans, with the director of the Smithsonian Food History Programming, as well. Paula Johnson, raise your hand, ladies, curator of food history. And for those of you who want to deep dive in on this story, please come to us for comment, but also they truly are going to be executing it when they hire their new museum scholar, which is kind of the first order of business. A second piece will be hiring a group of brewing history advisors, and then the project will truly roll out from there. So that's kind of tied to where we came from, you know, and where we're going today. Another marketplace endeavor that we're very engaged in, especially for the past 2 years, is that based on our research with an existing number of about 600 accredited culinary institutions in the United States, not one of them has beer on the same level of education as wine and spirits. Let me say that again. Of 600 accredited culinary institutions, not one of them has beer on the same level in their curriculums. And so we're working hard to advance that, especially based on sales. If you look at the beverage of beer, $105 billion market, compared to an estimated $40 billion for wine in sales for the United States in 2014, and spirits is about 60-some-odd billion. So just based on sales alone, we really are trying to empower the chefs of tomorrow to be as able to lead in food and wine as they are today. So it's something that we're actively working on and very interested in seeing doing. We're also getting ready to launch a Culinary Institute of America pilot program with our members for an externship, which would be an 18-week externship where brewery members are literally working with one of the main culinary institutions in the United States to get their students into their brew pubs and integrate them into the 15,000 estimated jobs from the 122,000 estimated jobs that the brewing community provides. So there are jobs there existing on the culinary side, and that's a pretty robust number. And then where we are today in another marketplace endeavor, just kind of a little call out to you guys and timing for your story ideas. May 16th to May 22nd will be American Craft Beer Week. We see every year an uptick in Google searches. Exponentially, the year continues to rise for interest on this National Beer Week that will have celebrations in all 50 states. So if you want to drop stories and time them and peg them to American Craft Beer Week, it's a great opportunity to have you guys potentially get more pickup on that. So something to consider. You know, I want to thank the Rosen Group before we wrap up to say that they're a conduit to us. So we're going to go into Q&A now, but if you need to get us afterwards and for some reason you don't know how, you already know how to get them because that's how you got credentialed. So always pay attention to that and be able to access them to get us if you need that. So, Keith, I think we're ready to go to Q&A at this portion of the time. Do you want to start with the phone?
Certainly, and at this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and one on your touch-tone phone. You can remove yourself by pressing the pound key. Once again, it's star and one. We'll pause just a moment to allow questions to queue. And Julia, we currently do have, we have no questions at this time.
Okay, well, I'm sure you guys will get warmed up. You're on the phone, you don't need to be shy, we can't see you. So in the room, do you want to come? We need you speaking into a microphone so we are able to get this to the phoners as well. What questions do you have? And Raquel's over here with a microphone, as well as Jeb right here.
Thank you very much. I'm Horst Stornbusch, and as most of you know, I've been in the craft brew industry for a quarter century as an author and a consultant and a brewer and a brewery owner. I have a question for Bob Pease, and I do not think I'm dumb, but I have never understood why it is not against the Federal Alcohol Administration Act of 1935 if a Tier 1 entity, that is a brewer, can actually own a Tier 2 entity, a distributor. A priori, I would think that should be a violation of that federal act. Why is it not so?
Horace, good to see you. Can everybody hear me?
Absolutely.
Federal Alcohol Administration Act 1935 is the primary piece of legislation that governs beverage alcohol at the federal level in this country. But I think the answer to your question is that the 21st Amendment really kicked authority to regulate beverage alcohol sales and distribution back to the state. And so at the state level, it is legal for a Tier 1, i.e. a supplier or a brewery, to own a Tier 2, i.e. a distributor, in 15 states. And currently, Anheuser-Busch InBev owns distributorships in 10 of those 15 states. More? Okay. Good.
Tony Forder, L Street News. I have a question regarding craft brewing definitions. I know the BA has changed its definitions in the past, and I'm wondering if there is a possibility that you have to continue to involve those definitions. Specifically, when a large brewery buys a small brewery, the beer is no longer craft, but when private equity makes an investment into a brewery, the beer still remains in the craft sector.
Sorry, I don't.
Kind of like a point and a question.
Yeah,
can you go to a direct question, Tony, and help?
So, Tony, was your question?
My question is why is it that when a large brewery acquires a small brewery, the beer is no longer classified as craft, whereas when private equity makes a large investment in a brewery, the brand still remains in the craft sector?
You know, the craft brewer definition is discussed and I think handled exclusively by the Brewers Association Board of Directors. And we see a fundamental difference between a purchase of a small and independent brewery by a large brewing company as opposed to private equity. Those primary differences of those being the access to raw materials and, most importantly, I think, the access to distribution. When you get sold to private equity or you sell a person to private equity, you get a capital infusion, but you do not get access to distribution. You do not get access to retail. You do not get access to the stadium accounts, and you do not get many of the advantages that come with being part of either the ABI world or the SAB Miller world.
Next question.
Hi, I'm Erica Bolden, and I'm a freelance journalist. And I had a question. It was either for Bart or Paul, based on the general session when you talked about anticipating with the styles and IPA obviously being where it is for sales, anticipating an uptick in Golden and Pilsner styles. And I was wondering if you can elaborate and maybe say where that research came from.
Sure. So those were specific examples of a general class of styles. The vast majority of the U.S. beer market still falls in more sessionable styles, lagers, light lagers, pilsners, golden ales, kolsches, blonde ales, the list goes on. And those have traditionally not been a huge percentage of craft brewers' portfolio. But when you look at the data, they're growing very rapidly. And I think the point there was it's a natural extension for craft brewers whose brands have resonated with beer lovers to begin moving into what is still the largest chunk of the U.S. beer market, those sessionable styles. And we're seeing that. There are brewers all across the country that are increasingly having tremendous success with things like Pilsners, things like Blonde Ales, things like Kolsches. If you were at the event at the Philadelphia Art Museum, the number of brewers who are pouring those styles is far higher than it used to be. Particularly as the millennials age a little bit and maybe look to integrate some more sessionable beers into their drinking occasions, I think it's only natural that they're going to look for those sessionable styles from the brands that they already know, love, and trust.
And I think Tides of Sessionable, we document 155 world beer styles. Those are available on brewersassociation.org. And the majority of them are under 6% alcohol. So I think that's an interesting tie-in. And if you ever need style guidelines to go to confirm things, we've got them.
Yeah. Can I jump in for 1 second and add one point? We heard from the general session that craft brewers, you know, make higher ABV. That's not necessarily true. Craft brewers have long made a variety of sessionable styles. And when we looked at this market-weighted picture, the average craft brewer beer a few years ago was 5.9% by ABV. So, you know, while the ones that are sometimes associated with them because they garner, you know, accolades are higher ABV, the vast majority of craft brewers are making very sessionable beers and you know, keeping with beer as the beverage of moderation.
Okay, we're going to go to a phone question now.
And we can go to Alicia Wallace with the Denver Post.
Hi, everyone. Bob, I think this message or this question is for you. Looking at the SAB Miller deal, what conditions are you seeking there in that transaction? And then outside of that, what protections are needed in the areas of distribution to preserve access to market for craft brewers?
Hello, Alicia. In December, I testified in front of the subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and in my testimony, the Brewers Association went on record that we would like to see the Department of Justice have Anheuser-Busch InBev divest of their wholly owned distributors. That would be meaning that they would sell off the distributorships that they own outright in those 10 different states. So that is certainly one of our remedies that we have requested. We are in an ongoing dialogue with the Department of Justice. I'm probably not going to get into some of our non-public discussions with them, but you know, we're on record as asking for divestiture of what we call branches from ABI. And, you know, what other, you know, remedies are needed? What is needed is a truly independent beer distribution system. One of the things that I did not mention in my brief summary of the government affairs talking about the deal in general is that, you know, Anheuser-Busch InBev has rolled out an incentive program. The acronym is VAIP, V-A-I-P, Voluntary Anheuser-Busch Incentive Program, that basically incentivizes their aligned, not owned, but aligned distributors not to sell brands that are over 15,000 barrels in volume in their house. We think that on its surface is anti-competitive in itself. We have no problem with Anheuser-Busch incentivizing their distributors to sell more Anheuser-Busch products. That's what I would do if I was controlling that distribution house. But for them to be able to incentivize distributors not to sell the brands of small and independent brewers is something that we'd like to see remedied.
We'll go to the next question in the room, please.
Hi, Kevin Wise. I'm from Buffalo, New York. I have an independent blog called The Buffalo Beer Biochemist. And so my question is really science related. I think you touched on some of the quality gaps, Paul, with the small breweries. So my question really has to do with what is the Brewers Association planning to do to encourage enhanced quality standards for beer for small breweries that really can't afford the equipment or don't have the resources or manpower or knowledge base to conduct these testings themselves?
Okay, we really started taking the quality issue head on as a national initiative a couple of years ago, and we created a quality subcommittee in our technical committee led by Jason Perkins, the Russell Shear Award winner for innovation in craft brewing. Some of the early work with that subcommittee was to identify what those gaps were and what we can do about that. Part of the initial work was a quality pyramid. Brewers who are the smallest brewers who don't have much in the way of financial resources to put to it, well, there are things you can do if you're that level of brewer. If you're a little bigger, there are other things you can add on top of that. And so it's a pyramid of six steps of progressive actions a brewer can take to improve their quality. In addition to that, we published a book, Quality Management, by Mary Pelletieri, and we sent that out free to all Brewers Association voting brewery members, as well as our breweries and planning, because breweries and planning are where a lot of the quality issues start. A lot of the brewers who start up come from the homebrewing ranks, and they are using different equipment, and they don't really know a lot of, you know, how the quality side really transfers there. There are other projects there on the quality side that are still being discussed. One of the things we do have is Dick Cantwell is contracted to be our quality ambassador, so he has been giving speeches at state guild gatherings where a bunch of brewers get together, have a technical conference, have some political strategy conferences. And so we've been sending Dick out on the road in a Wienermobile, but it looks like a beer. And so that's those are really the three things that we've undertaken so far.
There's also multiple quality-focused seminars going on at Craft Brewers Conference right now. Okay, thank you. Next question in the room. Multiple hands up.
Joe Stang with Draft Magazine. How much concern is there that with not only the big merger but ongoing ABI acquisitions that small and independent brewers could lose access to the ingredients they want to make the beers that they want?
I'll take that one, at least to start. The a lot on the ingredient side is based on the research side that, you know, takes years for barley lines, for example, to go through the process. For a hop variety to come to market, will often take, 7 years. And one of the things with the merger that does concern us, for the last few years, Anheuser-Busch InBev has sort of been their own unit when it comes to research. Miller and Coors sort of joined into one unit. Now internationally with Miller being associated closer to Anheuser-Busch, that's going to change what varieties are in demand. The fact that there's one very huge buyer is going to significantly impact, what lines come to be. And so craft brewers are going to have to make it known what they want, how much of it they want, and to demand research in the varieties that that they're looking for. So there is it takes a while for it really to play out on the international scale in terms of the impacts of on the raw materials. Also, when you're buying at that scale, you get different pricing, and you get the first one there.
Next question.
Nick Manis from MIBiz in Michigan. I think kind of noticed that craft breweries are increasingly seen as kind of tools for economic development and community revitalization. I'm wondering if the BA is hearing anything from its members as far as breweries increasingly in more urban areas, suburban, rural. Any trends or data that you're noticing there?
I'll take that one. I think that the trend is diversity in geographic locations. One statistic we've tracked, which I didn't present, was the percentage of 21 plus adults that live within 10 miles of a brewery. And that's now above 75% of 21-plus adults live within 10 miles of a brewery. You don't get that if breweries haven't diversified outside of, the traditional college town environment that they were associated with 10 years ago. We haven't done anything yet specifically on, economic development in disadvantaged areas, but that's certainly, one reason they've been so popular with local areas. So, one advantage breweries have is their manufacturing business, and so they can go into areas that are zoned for manufacturing and revitalize and bring foot traffic back to areas in formerly industrial areas. There have been a number of great stories documenting this. And there is one economics paper I'm aware of by Dr. Stephen Weiler, who was at Colorado State. I believe he's since moved on, about the Wynkoop Brewery in Lodo in Denver, which, for those who don't know the story, they moved in there because it was the cheapest real estate they could find, and that's now one of the ritziest parts of Denver. Good luck finding a storefront.
$1 a square foot, I think.
$1 a square foot, as Bob adds. So certainly there are a lot of stories there around that economic development.
That urban revitalization theme is just something that plays really, really well on Capitol Hill. The number of members of Congress that now are interested in visiting a small and independent brewery, and seeing those manufacturing jobs has just swollen exponentially. There's not many industries in the United States that can say that over the last 25 years they've created 120,000 jobs, many of those manufacturing jobs, and many of those manufacturing jobs in urban environments.
If you're a stats geek like me, and you can go through the economic census data, one of the best data sources available, and look for manufacturing industries that have created jobs between the 2007 and 2012 economic censuses. Sensei? I should know that. And brewing is one of the few.
And I'm going to jump in and share a stat that we've been sharing lately. There's tremendous opportunity still. We do get asked, are there too many breweries? And one of the answers back is we estimate there's 1,000 towns with populations of 10,000 people or more that still have no breweries in the United States. So it's a good statistic to tie it back to the current opportunities that still exist to those breweries and planning that have yet to open up. Next question in the room.
Hi, I'm Steve Pintarelli with Beverage Industry Magazine. This is a question for Bob. In terms of the Anheuser-Busch InBev acquisition of SAB Miller, I was hoping you could clarify one or two items. You've spoken today about a number of anti-competitive issues and concerns, which, as I see it, already exist within the United States. As things are currently structured, it's been fairly well documented and understood that they will not acquire the MillerCoors operations in the U.S.
Correct.
The Justice Department would not approve that, and I think they already know that up front. That'll be remaining. We'll be going to Molson's of Canada, and that will remain independent as it is today. Can you just clarify why you see these concerns, since the combination is really going to affect the rest of the world and not so much the U.S.?
Well, I'm not so sure I'm going to agree with that this is not going to affect the U.S. I know that's the party line coming out of the Anheuser-Busch team, but the U.S. represents the most profitable beer market in the world. So we think this deal has a whole lot to do with the U.S. When I look at what right now the beer landscape, ABI has a fairly formidable competitor in MillerCoors in the United States. When this deal goes through unchecked, the number two company is going to be an emaciated Molson Coors. They are not going to be any near the competitor to ABI that Miller Coors is right now. Yes, ABI's market share in the United States is not going to be increased if this deal goes through, but then we pivot right back to, again, their increased influence at the distributor tier and how that is just potentially negatively going to impact small and independent breweries who, again, by and large, are required to use a distributor to get their products to market. In most markets, there's only really two viable distributors with horsepower, and that's an ABI-aligned distributor or a MillerCoors-aligned distributor. And if the ABI-aligned distributor is more focused or even closed off to small and independent breweries, that eliminates one path to market for our members.
Thank you, Bob.
Next question.
Thanks. Brian Roth, freelance writer. I'm curious, obviously, the community within beer is very welcoming, and you see all sorts of people in all sorts of places. But one of the continuing conversations that I think, at least I know I've had and I've talked to other people, is about the idea of inclusivity and diversity, whether that's race, ethnicity, gender identity. And so I'm curious if there are any particular things that the BA is doing to further this conversation or even make sure that the conversation is being had to address perceived issues that may be within the community.
A lot of different ways to answer that question. You want to go stats and Stanford?
Sure.
Stanford.
I'll mention a couple of things. You know, one is we are trying to gather some statistics to understand, where the industry stands. Worked with a team at Stanford University, Susan Sewell and Dr. Shelley Carell should be credited if you use this data, and they found that a little bit more than a fifth 20% of owners, founders, or CEOs or brewmasters in the beer industry when they coded the data set we sent them in 2014 were female. And so we're working with them to look and see how that gets changed. Obviously, you know, we do what we can to support beer industry groups like Pink Boots Society that support women in beer. You know, on the technical side, you know, one thing we're doing to help promote diversity. We talking about draft calling
manual?
Is one of the things that the technical committee is doing is we're going to translate a draft quality manual into Spanish. So that's on their agenda to make sure that those messages, the ones we preach about, you know, high levels of draft quality are making it to more diverse communities. I'll pause there and pass to others who may have other things to add.
The Export Development Program has a series of publications that we've used some of our government grant funding for, American Craft Beer, American Craft Beer Guide, American Craft Beer and Food Guide, the Brewers Association Export Guide to Quality. All of those have been translated into a variety of different languages, Spanish, Portuguese, Chinese, Swedish, and we're pretty proud of that. Horst has helped us with one, the most recent one in German, right? Yeah.
My little piece of it is that beer has no gender or race, although it definitely skews. If you look at the craft brewing segment of small and independent craft brewers and data from Nielsen, 32% of the craft beer comes from women purchasing that, and that's much higher than the 20-some-odd percent of the mass domestics. So at least encouraging-wise, we are growing a segment and supporting the brewery members that are bringing more women back to beer. So that's a quick hit answer.
I have nothing to add.
Next question. Anything on the phone?
We have no phone questions, but I'll remind everyone it's star and one to ask a question.
Okay, and we do have a new question in the room.
Hello, Terry Allen with MarketWatch Magazine, the trade publication. This question is for Bart. Do you have a projection at this point as to what type of growth you'll see for craft beer in 2016?
We don't. We've never done projections, which, you know, I think would be increasingly complicated given the incredible diversity and also the number of the amount of activity that happens that's hard to measure in the short term. You know, one reason we resist putting out too many growth numbers is that scan data and some of the other data sources don't capture a lot of the dynamism that goes on in craft brewing. As I said from the stage, I think it's only natural to expect slower growth than we've seen. As the base gets bigger, you know, law of large numbers kicks in, and we're starting to see, you know, that it's hard to hit those same growth rates that we've hit before. So, you know, I would say it's safe to say that below 13% is likely. You know, how far down it will go, you know, clearly there are still a lot of success stories, and the scan data is still showing, you know, high single digits growth so far this year, but nothing beyond that.
Not just volume growth. The craft segment will continue to grow in exponential different ways. So just to frame that in that.
Yeah, we're certainly seeing, you know, a lot of growth, too, in where craft is. You know, one thing I didn't talk about is, you know, penetration of other retail channels. You know, one largely untapped source of growth for craft brewing is convenience. Convenience is the largest beer channel by volume. And the last time I checked, craft had like 2.5 share of convenience. As craft brewers increasingly, you know, figure out formats that work for that channel in terms of packaging, figure out, you know, ways to market and get better at those scale retailer presentations, convenience could be a huge source of untapped growth for, you know, particularly regional craft brewers.
As long as you have a distributor.
So we'll go back to the phone for a question.
And we'll go to Josh Noel with the Chicago Tribune.
Hey there. I got cut out of the call for a couple of minutes, so if you already addressed this, I apologize. But I'm curious on your take on the consolidation that's happening in the form of one craft buying another craft. Is that any drawbacks to that, or is that ultimately a good thing? And what's the impact of the industry?
When we do see consolidation within craft, usually it's the relationship starts with people who are already friends, and one of them is trying to grow their scale or maybe access a different part of the country, and the other one's like, well, we can help with that. You know, when Perrin was talking to Oscar Blues, for example, you know, they're friends. Alpine and Green Flash would be another example of that. The collaborations certainly continue in craft, and those conversations can eventually lead to something. But yeah, I think it's just it's something that happens a little bit here and there. When it does happen, sometimes the craft brewer is able to afford it themselves. Other times they do need to bring in capital, either through local banks or maybe private equity.
Thank you, Josh. Another question to the phone? From the phone.
We can go to Tom Wilms with Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Please go ahead.
Yes. Hi, thanks. You all had some great insight around some of the challenges with domestic distribution. I'm wondering if you can talk a bit more about craft exports and international distribution channels. Are those some of the same challenges? What are the opportunities internationally? And a little bit more about how the Brewers Association is working to ease the way.
I'll take that one. The opportunities for international distribution are significant. The biggest challenge for international distribution is maintaining the quality for American craft beer exports. In the United States, we're fortunate to have, by and large, not universally, but by and large, there is a cold chain of distribution from a temperature from a brewery to a temperature-controlled warehouse to often temperature-controlled refrigerated trucks to a cold box, and so that the craft beer, which by and large is not pasteurized, is maintained, because the enemy of beer quality is time and light and temperature fluctuations. In the international communities, that type of infrastructure, by and large, does not exist. One of our messages with when we go out into the world and meet and explore new markets is that the distributor, the importer and the distributor that's willing to invest in that type of infrastructure has the best chance of working with an independent American craft brewery. We love to see the beer shipped on in a refrigerated container. Obviously, that is a business decision that adds a ton of cost to the formula of exporting. But we are seeing increased awareness and increased implementation of cold chain in different parts of the world, and we'll continue to just drive home that message. One of the things that the Brewers Association does with our export program is we kind of act as a matchmaker for our breweries that are interested in distributing. So we use the funding from the Department of Agriculture to go out and meet with and visit importers and distributors, and we tour their facilities, and we see what type of beers they're handling, and we see what type of quality care methods they have in place, and then we'll report back to our members about what we found. We don't pick or choose any one distributor or qualify a distributor, but we do like to do our research and then provide that information to our members and say, here is a potential viable trading partner for you. And that formula has proven to be successful.
And in March of 2015, we released the 2014 stats, a press release that you can reference off of brewersassociation.org that has a little more deep dive on what's going on with the export development efforts from our side. Next question.
Hi, Brad Wren from the Reading Eagle here in Pennsylvania. Could one of you just talk a little bit about this event, the CBC, how it's grown over the years, and what the different participants get out of it, from the brewers to the exhibitors to even yourself at the BA?
Paul, you want to take that? Sure. The Craft Brewers Conference, this started as an event paired with the American Home Brewers Conference, and there was this nice little evening event called the Great American Beer Festival at one of the early ones that has then, gone on and grown legs and become its own very large event. Since the turn of the century, our low point in attendance was 995 in New Orleans in 2003. I haven't checked in with registration, but I think we were at 12.7 a week and a half ago, so I don't know what the on-site has been or the pickup since then. So good chance we're over 13,000 in attendance here. The trade show has grown astronomically. Bob mentioned in Seattle 10 years ago we had 40,000 square feet of exhibit space. We're over 500,000 square feet now and 835 exhibitors. And it's just for those of us who have been here a long time, it's a little mind-boggling. What attendees get out of it is, they get information that helps them with their business. They also get the access to each other. The networking here, helps the ideas start to get shared around. Also, I think there's, just the hospitality side of things that people feel good. They're talking to friends, and they're drinking beer, and they're having a good time, and then they're going out at night and drinking another beer, and it makes it really fun. I think for a lot of our attendees, this is a really, really fun event. For the association, this does drive our ability to do a lot of our other activities here. We're unique as a trade association in that dues are, a smaller percentage of our revenues, but we're diversified through our events, through our book publishing. So, this is a key component of us being able to take a relatively small amount of dues revenue and parlay that into a large amount of activity.
I think I think one of the things I'm most proud of is back in the day when we did not have the resources that the Brewers Association has now, we couldn't have all these fancy graphics with our logo all over the place. We used to have this banner that we would hang that says, we build communities. And I think that's what we do, is we bring the beer industry together. And I'm really proud of that.
Yeah, convention center or not. And we've only been in convention centers for a few years, and we wanted everyone that's able to, that wants to go to their main industry annual conference to be able to attend. So the convention center feel is definitely a little different for staff. Different animal, but it's still a beautiful, wonderful thing to see 13,000 people showing up to do this. And I also want to take a moment to point out another spokesperson in the room for the Brewers Association. When it comes specifically to events, Barbara Fusco, our Director of Marketing and Sales, is in the back and just raised her hand, and she's also a great source for comment on our events. Next question, or we're out of time? Oh, we're out of time. Of course, we'll talk to you any time. Just come on up. So I want to thank you guys. Quick hits for on the phone and in the room. One of the parts of this community stems from homebrewing. Homebrewersassociation.org is there for you, too. It doesn't necessarily maybe come on your radar, but if you need story ideas, pay attention to what's going on in homebrewing community. In 1978, we were the American Homebrewers Association. We now have 46,000 homebrewing members, and it's a huge part of the craft segment of what's going on, our homebrewers. I also want to make sure you guys are connecting with your state guilds on brewersassociation.org. We have a list of all of them and the contacts. If you're media in a certain state and you're not interfacing with your state guild representatives, they could help you more on the local level than even we can sometimes. So that's important. And then just a reminder, your digital Craft Brewers Conference media kit is available in the press section on the craftbrewersconference.com website. As well as the state of the industry is there. So we want to thank you for your time and attention to paying attention to small and independent craft brewers and for you guys having to attend the conference and the press conference. Have a great rest of the day.